Welcome back to the program. You know, the current economic crisis is certainly causing economic pain and dislocation in all areas of the country. As we move through the crisis, it'll certainly have long-term consequences on who we are as a nation, how we live, but also where we live. Our determination and our sense of place will forever be altered as a result of the current crisis. This is the backdrop of an article currently in The Atlantic by a guest that has been with us before. He is Richard Florida. He's currently a professor and head of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. He's the author of the groundbreaking books, The Rise of the Creative Class, The Flight of the Creative Class, and Hoosier City. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new story, The Great Reset, How the Crash Will Reshape America. It is the cover story in the March issue of The Atlantic. Richard Florida, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, thanks for having me back on again. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you here. One of the things that you talk about is the physical character of economies, the physical character of changes, major changes that have taken place in the U.S. economy. Talk a little about that.
Well, I'm kind of shocked, really, at how minimized or how neglected this is in the current debate over economic recovery. And, you know, probably like most listeners, I was a huge Barack Obama's fan, and I'm a big fan of the administration. And I listened intently to the speech the other night. It was actually, I expected it to not be as, it was better than I expected. I was actually quite moved by this optimistic outlook. But when I look at what our government is proposing to do to kind of rebuild or restart the U.S. economy, I see, you know, a bank bailout, which is problematic. We don't need to go into that. But I see a housing plan that simply wants to reflate, is the word I would use, our old traditional way of doing housing, and an infrastructure plan or stimulus plan that is really all about rebuilding. I mean, there are some nods to green energy and high-speed rail, and especially in California, but really about rebuilding the infrastructure of the post-war U.S. Well, for this thing in The Atlantic, I went back and I looked at the two big, I looked at every recession, but I looked particularly closely at the two big so-called depressions that had affected the U.S. and world economies before. The first one is, obviously, we know about the Great Depression. My father told me about it, the New Deal period. And the other one was in the 1870s, started in 1873. It was called the Long Depression. Well, if you look at how we recovered from both of those, yes, government began to play more of a role. Yes, in the 1930s, there was this New Deal and this stimulus. Yes, certainly World War II played a role in helping us recover. But in the earlier one, the 1870s, what made the U.S. economy recover is we were, at the outset of that, an agricultural country. When we came out of that, we not only had a more effective steel industry, but we became a country of industrial cities, the Detroits, the Clevelands, the Pittsburghs, the Buffaloes, the Chicagos, so, and even San Francisco's and Western cities to a certain degree. But it was the industrial city that changed the way we live and caused our economy to grow again. And even more powerfully, out of the Great Depression, it wasn't just Keynesianism or the New Deal or the war. Mm-hmm. It was the development of this mass suburbanization. And when you think about it, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. My parents bought a suburban house in New Jersey. That was like the fuel of the engine of the auto age. You know, they had to buy a car. They had like a Chevy. They had to buy, you know, and I remember all these RCA television sets before there were Japanese television sets in the U.S. They had, you know, a Kelvinator refrigerator. Mm-hmm. They had an Electrolux vacuum cleaner. They had a Maytag washer and dryer. They bought window air conditioning. So all of, and you know, this big giant console stereo, I think it was a Magnavox, all of these products coming off the assembly lines, they found a home, literally and figuratively, found a home in suburbanization. So what the article argues, what I argue, is that it's going to take a change in the way we live and where we live and how we live to open up new patterns of demand and consumption that will power innovation and technology. And just for folks listening in your neck of the woods, I think we spend way too much on housing and cars. And just like in before we could have like an industrial society, we had to make agricultural goods less expensive. In this economy, we're going to have to make housing and transportation and energy less expensive so people can spend money on all of the technologies and knowledge goods and creative goods and intangible goods that are going to power our economic recovery.
Before we talk about the recovery aspect, one of the other points you made is that to a certain degree, that the causes of this crash are geographic in nature. Talk about that.
Well, absolutely. I think there's no other way to understand the crash. And it's interesting for folks listening in, you know, if you've read some of my work on the creative economy and this and that, my dissertation was on housing and mortgages. And I wrote that in the 1980s at Columbia University. So this was a way for me to come back to my most original kind of intellectual interests. And what really caused this crash is our pattern of post-war suburbanization, this idea that every American has a right to a single-family house. This was a great ideal, and I say in the piece, this fit in well in a system when workers had one job. My dad, this mm-hmm. is a great example, my dad had one job. He got it in 1934. He then spent some time in World War II. He came back to the same job. He had in that job until he turned from 13 when he got his working papers. He dropped out of junior high until 65 when he retired. My parents had one house. They had one house in North Arlington, New Jersey, that they bought when I was 2 years old. They moved out of their little rental apartment they lived in for a couple of years in Newark, New Jersey. And my brother was born there, and they lived there their entire lives. Well, they had a mortgage with the local savings and loan that they paid off, and that savings and loan kept it. But the system that we developed of flipping mortgages and speculating and turning the house into a virtual ATM, I wrote about this back in the 90s and early 2000s. I mean, the idea that we thought we could build and float consumption using the house as literally a piggy bank to take money out of it was insane. So now in a robust, technology-driven, highly creative, entertainment-oriented economy, we've let housing take us down. There is no doubt that housing has been the major contributor to our economic and financial collapse. And more than that, we're now trapped. Maybe less so where you guys are, but say you're a person in Detroit or Buffalo, mm-hmm. and your job is dried up in the auto industry or in one of the old industries, and you have to move. Well, you can't. You're stuck. So in an economic system where you're not like my dad, working in one industrial factory job for life, and your livelihood depends on your ability to move to where new work is, you're stuck with this incredible liability. It's not only underwater, and you're not only losing money on it, you can't sell it. You can't get rid of it. You can't exit. You can't leave. So if labor mobility, if job mobility is a key part, I think, of the real American dream, the ability to move and harness economic opportunity, this thing we call the dream of home ownership has come into contradiction with that. And that's why I think our system of housing has to change if we're going to begin to build a really innovative, knowledge-driven, entrepreneurial economy that can thrive and prosper in this new century.
It's interesting that we have not seen this coming in one key respect. One of the things that we've heard about for a long time, I mean, you've certainly talked about it, but others have talked about it for a long time, is the mobility of the current information-based economy and the idea of people moving more freely from job to job and the shifts in the geographic landscape of where those jobs are. But we never, ever connected the dots between that and the housing issue.
Because it's not an issue when your housing is increasing in value and booming. Because then people can, you know, they had the whole flipper, turn on your HGTV or whatever station, they're still running the shows, you know, flip this, flip that, flip the other one. So when you could flip houses like nothing and there was great demand, you know, especially in the hot spots, you know, the Bay Area, Washington, D.C., New York metro area, Boston, Seattle. Yeah. But when you're stuck and nobody wants to buy your house, so now we have a zombie economy, an economy that's completely locked up, where nobody can sell their house. You can't even get a mortgage over the so-called conforming limit. It's just usurious interest rates, and the down payments are extravagant. So everybody is sort of locked in place, and I think, you know, this is where the administration has got to wake up. If we can't unfreeze the housing market, we're cooked. And if the cornerstone of our economy is labor flexibility, job flexibility, mobility, if we're saying, you know, the average person has something like seven jobs in their lifetime, young people are switching jobs every year, a stable job economy is the old industrial way, and we can't go back to that. So if we want to build a modern economy, if our people aren't mobile, we're cooked. And if we're going to restore our competitiveness and prosperity, we have to be mobile. And that's why I say in the piece, I think we've got to seriously consider moving away from mass home ownership. Now, there are some people who really, really want a house, and they know they're going to stay there for a long time, and they can afford it, and they can make a 30% down payment, and they don't mind if they lose a little money, that's fine. But for most people, not only the cost of entry, buying the house, but the cost of exit and the time cost of exit are so high that in this kind of environment, I just think people have to think long and hard about possibly becoming renters. And I think there are things our country could do to make renting a lot better and more fulfilling and a better, a higher quality experience.
Uh-huh. What about the broader issue of suburbanization, and in, particularly in places like the West and the Sun Belt, and even some places that have grown, like North Carolina, in the South?
Well, I said in this piece that there, you know, everyone was talking, and it's amazing to me, in a way, sometimes how short-sighted people, oh my God, New York's going to get killed. No, New York is not going to get killed. I mean, New York has weathered the Long Depression, the Great Depression, and every recession in between come out stronger. It's arguably the world's most diverse, thriving, creative city. London may vie for it. And you know, the interesting thing is I looked at London. Here's a city that was down on its knees after World War II as the English Empire collapsed, and still has come back as one of the two dominant financial centers and creative media entertainment centers in the world. So I say in the piece there are two kinds of places that are going to get really hit and hurt by this economic crisis. The first we talked about, these old industrial cities that have lost their kind of industrial reason for existence. So the Detroits, the Buffaloes, the Clevelands, even Pittsburgh, and I talk about Pittsburgh where I live, it's stable, but it's got hard times. It's not going to grow vibrantly. The other places I think that are due for a big, big reset and reshuffling are these classical Sunbelt cities. I call them the cities in the sand, where literally they didn't have an economic reason to exist. Now, you might say in a place like Las Vegas, it had gaming and casinos, and that was great for tourism. But what happened in a place like Phoenix, and Phoenix has some industry, and I'm quite a fan of Phoenix in some ways, but what happened was the real estate industry became then the dominant industry. It overtook gaming and all the other industries. And people thought, well, we could build an economy based on flipping homes. So I actually looked at the data, and about 25 to 30% of those entire economies were based on real estate, construction, and transactions. Bigger than government, bigger than healthcare, bigger than education, bigger than manufacturing, by a large, perhaps six or seven times bigger than manufacturing. Well, those economies have nothing left, and it's not surprising that their housing prices have been devastated and unemployment rates. In Phoenix, the Phoenix metropolitan area for the first time, and the city for the first time, are going to experience population decline in this cycle. So those cities are in deep, deep trouble. Now, I don't think suburbanization is over, and I disagree with many of my friends who are canonical urbanists. And they say, well, the suburbs are dead and they're gone. No. The history of capitalism, if you really study it the way we have at our institute, is of the more intensive use of our space, of our place. So we went from agricultural villages to small commercial towns, to giant industrial cities, to what we call these metropolitan city suburban, the Bay Area, greater New York, greater Boston, greater Washington, greater Seattle. The metropolitan city suburban area actually let us use our geography, our places, even more intensively. We spread out industry and commerce and residents. I think today we're shifting to yet again another more intensive way of using our geography in a new living pattern. I call it the mega region. In the Bay Area, that's the whole greater San Francisco area, the Cascadia up in the Pacific Northwest that goes from Portland to Seattle to Vancouver, and then the classic one that I think of, the Boston, Washington, New York, 50 million people, $2 trillion in economic output. Those are becoming infilled and packed up, and the suburbs are becoming even denser, and they're becoming multiple business centers. There's not just one business center like there was in the old. Think about the whole Bay Area. There's the Silicon Valley, there's San Francisco, there's Oakland, there's Napa, there's Davis. There are multiple, Sacramento, there are multiple hubs in there. And then what you do is over time, those begin to infill and grow and become denser throughout. That's why I think things like high-speed rail and better infrastructure connectivity are going to be so critical. Now, if we want to grow, if we don't want to grow, if we want to be a backward economy, that's fine and go back to the past. But if we want to grow as a country, we're going to need to do those things to make our population and our density and our connective fiber better and more intensive.
There is also the nexus between that kind of growth in those areas and even the competition within those mega regions with respect to the economic underpinnings of the communities and the cities along the way.
Well, you know, if we want to be an economic power in this next century, we got to get over those hang-ups. And we may say we can't. You know, we're trapped by our local, municipal, state. We're going to fight with one another, be dysfunctional, then sooner or later, somebody will pass us by. I'm not sure who, and it may take another 70-year economic cycle, a long cycle, but sooner or later, this will catch up with us. I think already our suburban kind of spatial pattern and our sprawl has put us at an economic competitiveness disadvantage. Now, we're a rich country. We're a very inventive country. We've been able to attract the world's best brains, so we've overcome it. But in the future, the not only the use of energy, but the time cost of commuting and just the congestion problems are going to eat us alive. And then if our, you know, Sacramento wants to shoot at Davis and, you know, San Francisco wants to shoot at Oakland and Oakland wants to shoot at San Jose, we're done. So, and that may be the thing that ultimately comes to erode our competitiveness in the United States. But I certainly don't see this stuff in Canada. You know, I'm an American. I live in Greater Toronto. The premier, who's our version of a governor, he's on board. Our mayor of Toronto, he's on board. We made a Greater Toronto Area. We put all the municipalities together. We don't have these things called counties. People go, well, what the heck's a county? That's another level of government. Everybody, no, I don't want to say everybody's on completely the same page, and of course people are ambitious, but we're going to build a whole mega region here that runs from the west of Toronto through Toronto over to Ottawa and hopefully Montreal with a high-speed rail connection. And people were willing to think that way. Now, I'm not going to say Canada is going to beat the U.S., but I'll tell you, if Toronto does this, it will gain ground on some of the U.S. centers, and it has a nice economic mix. The point is, in the U.S., we've got to get with this, and we've got to get out of this old thinking that somehow if we reflate the auto industry and we rebuild housing and we just go back to the past, we won't. We will not. We will fall further behind. We have to build something new that's in line with what we've built in this creative economy. And you can see its outline in the Bay Area. I mean, you can see it very clearly. And I think most people know intuitively how you would build it. But there's just so many rigidities and kind of, we call a sclerosis in our political system that it's just hard to accomplish.
It is no accident relative to that if we look at the major industrial nations that Canada has held up pretty much better than anybody else in this crisis.
Well, you know, I mean, I'd like to credit my own ability to pick locations, but I was kind of blown away by the stability of Canada's banks, and I was just with the head of the Bank of Canada and another banker. I did a panel with them. I was honored to be on the panel. But they were joking. They said, you know, last year we were like the 20th and 25th largest bank in the world. Now we're like 4th and 5th, and they were joking. They're saying, well, in the next month we'll be 2nd and 3rd, and we didn't do anything. We just let the other banks collapse. And I think that there is a sense now that Canada can make a move. Now, not all of Canada. It's the Vancouver area, the Greater Toronto area. But I think I don't see that same kind of thinking. Now, I do think Obama is phenomenal, and I think he's created a whole new environment for thought. But I don't see this kind of thinking. And maybe we just in the U.S. were hit by such a big crisis that we've been set back on our heels, and we need a little bit of time to recover. But now, where the mayor sees this, where somebody like Gavin Newsom sees it, or some of the governors see it, a mayor like John Hickenlooper in Denver sees it, even Mike Bloomberg is doing marvelous things to move away from finance in New York and get back to entrepreneurship and creativity and not so dependent on Wall Street. And some of the governors, I just see our federal government being completely dead, you know, above the neck. And I mean, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 3 years and, you know, tried my best to go help and engage in dialogue with these people. And they could care less. I mean, they were concerned with foreign policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq and, you know, defense this and foreign policy that. And you know, now it's bailing out the banks and bailing out the mortgage. And you know, how could this country spend so much time talking about a defunct auto company that has management, the most incompetent management on the planet, squandered $30 billion loss in 1 year, making cars people don't want to buy, squandering the greatest advantage you could imagine. And we're talking about bailing these people out when we can build new industries. Take them, move, sell them off. You know, let somebody else take them, and like they did in steel. Finally, the thing got fixed when they let them go bankrupt. But how can we be having a debate? It would be as if we're in 1930. And instead of Franklin Roosevelt talking about building an industrial age and building suburbanization, he'd be saying, well, no, we have to fix the farms. What we really need to do in America in 1930 is instead of building autos and electric and chemicals, we got to fix our farm communities, and we have to reinvest in our farms. Huh? I mean, I don't see how out of touch a debate could get. So we have an obligation to our country as Americans to say, no, we have a future. We can see that future. It's in technology, it's innovation, it's in a new way of living, and God, you know, I said this in the piece. My father always told me, never count America down, because it has this incredible capacity, its people, to turn on a dime. And I wouldn't count us down again, but boy, oh boy, we need a change in the way we think, and we need it fast.
Certainly part of the problem in terms of our lack of nimbleness and not being able to respond to this is the sclerosis in our political process, no question about that. To what extent do you see geography and the issues that you talk about and write about as having played a role in leading to the kind of political paralysis that we have today?
Well, my hope is that Obama can get us beyond this, and I think he's our great hope in this, and this is what I see in his attempt to unify us. But certainly in a book I wrote in 2004 called Flight of the Creative Class, I pointed this out quite clearly as being, in addition to our geographic pattern, or overlaid with our geographic pattern, this political sclerosis being a nub of why we're going to be in such deep doo-doo. And the fact of the matter is, it's a class-divided society. We have relatively wealthy, more affluent people packed into these cities and mega regions like the Bay Area, New York, Boston, Washington, Chicago, even the Charlotte, Atlanta corridor. And people outside those corridors feeling, you know, look at the recession. 80% of the people who've been made laid off are men. The so-called industrial working class of the Midwest has borne the brunt of the recession. Double digit, if not even bigger, 20% perhaps in some areas, unemployment. The professionals, the creatives, the city, yes, it's been hit. Don't get me wrong, of course. But your unemployment rates are 4, 5, 6%, and people are able, because they have skill and education, to retool. They may lose a little money, but it's not like they're going to go into the poorhouse. So this has created tremendous anxiety and tremendous anger in our population. And you see it, and I viscerally feel it in the United States. So that means our society is polarized. We're in a culture war. You have people blaming everybody, immigrants, you know, gays, lesbians, young people, hippies, yuppies are all at fault, when in fact the problems are really structural. And we've got to get beyond this. And I hope Obama can get, I think that's the great thing about Obama. I hope, because of his personal fortitude and his own experiences as a multiracial person who grew up largely outside the mainland United States, he sees this so clearly, and I hope he can get us beyond this. I fear for the president that he's so constrained not only by partisan politics, but what I would call the traditional Democratic constituencies, and not just labor.
Right.
A whole range of Democratic constituencies, from real estate to finance and all the rest, I think that hems him in a way that I hope he's nimble enough and entrepreneurial enough, and, you know, he has to be a genius, and I think he's as close as we can get. He's genius enough to be able to break the backs of those coalitions. Roosevelt did it, and they called Roosevelt, they called him a class traitor. I mean, his own people hated him. Mm. But he was able to overcome all of this and put together a new strategy for our country. I think Obama has the capability, and I'm hoping with the right support he can get there. But right now, boy, oh boy, when you look at some of the things he's hemmed in by, it's a Sisyphean task to get us there.
But as you write it at the end of your piece, How the Crash Will Reshape America, as you write at the end, it really is the current crisis that we're in that provides the opportunity to perhaps finally address some of these issues.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think in terms of the leading edge segments of the economy, technology, entertainment, innovation, I mean, America has them. People talk about military dominance, military. We own those segments of the economy, and we own them because we're open, because we've been, look at that Academy Awards. I mean, we can look at the Valley, right, and look at all the high-tech entrepreneurs from other countries, but look at the Academy Awards. All those people making films in America with Americans, how many of them were for all over the world, right? It was a perfect example of America as it's a bit talent-attracting machine, and our mega regions is a talent-attracting machine. I think we can do it. I'm just the only thing that makes me nervous is how wedded we seem to be, and our leaders seem to be to the past. You know, when the Swedish minister, when they went over there with Saab and GM, was, you know, we're going to get rid of this thing. We bought it. It's no longer making money. Here, we're going to give you Saab back, bail it out. And the Swedish minister, this woman who I've actually met, said, you know, in the land of socialism and social democracy and help the workers, she said, thank you, but no thank you. We're not in the business of bailing out mismanaged car companies. You know what we do for our people? We make sure they have great nursery care for their kids. We make sure that we have great nursery schools and preschools so kids can get a head start. We make sure that our education system is amongst the best in the world and they have free higher education. You know what else we make sure? We make sure that all of our people have health care. So when they're laid off, they're not indigent, so that there's a social safety net that they can fall back on. And she said, you know what we're going to do? we're going to put that money in investing in research and development for cars and next generation clean technology. And yes, if Saab can make it, they can participate in our research and technology investment in the future of a car industry of the future. Why can't we do this? If Sweden, if little tiny Sweden can do it, why can't we do this? Why can't we say enough's enough, no more bailouts? If you failed, you failed. And we're going to get on with what America does best, building a new economy, building, investing in technology. You know, with this great economist, Joseph Schumpeter, said, we have the market cornered on creative destruction. Mm-hmm. We destroy the old by building the new. Well, that also has a place component. Why aren't we at the cutting edge of investing in this new way of living? Like we invented suburbanization, like we invented the great industrial city before. Why can't we we have the mega regions. They're there in the East Coast, the West Coast, the middle of the country. Why can't we knit them together with high, why can't we knit them together with high-speed rail? Why can't we densify? Why can't we move from home ownership to rental? Why can't we roll up all of these foreclosed condos and these vacant buildings and the houses that are sitting empty? Why can't we encourage entrepreneurship in companies to come and roll them all up and rent them back and make them beautiful and rent them back to people? Imagine if we had a housing system where big management companies took all of these defunct properties, turned them into affordable, beautiful, affordable, wired-up rentals, rented them to people, and people could move and pick and choose as they please, bringing down housing costs, connected with high-speed rail so we could bring down transit and transportation. It's easy to see, right? It's hard to execute. Mm-hmm. And I think the country or regions that do this first will get a huge first-mover advantage. I'm afraid, as an American, I'm afraid that we're lagging in that. But I note, you know, my father always told me, we went into World War II completely unmobilized, and we mobilized and turned on a dime. So I'm hoping somewhere, someplace in the States can step up to the bar and lead us into this future.
To what extent is our inability to make some of those changes a result of the fact that they will arguably be more losers than winners in that creative destruction, and that we still have a country where only 25% of the country has a college education?
Well, that's why I loved when the president said and people have pointed out how far ahead Sweden and Canada and Norway are of us in our college educational attainment. And my father always told me, he said, I have a seventh grade education, son. You better get your butt to college and stay out of the factory, get to college and get a degree and find a career. You know, my dad wanted me to be a doctor or a dentist or a lawyer. He didn't understand that I wanted to be a professor. But finally, after I did it, it paid off. And then he understood. He saw more of a professional. But I think the way to do it is really simple. And I wrote about this in Rise of the Creative Class. Mm-hmm. And for the life of me, I can't understand. We just did a report, actually, for the premier, the equivalent of our governor of Ontario. They've adopted it here. Every single human being is creative. That's the way around this. We're no longer going to build our economy by every person being kind of alienated in their jobs, or a third of our population or 50% of our population having crappy jobs that they hate and going out and having to buy their happiness by buying a new handbag or a new car or a new stereo system or a new flat screen TV. The only way we're going to build a real society is by giving people real purpose and enabling them to use their full talents. Now, the reason I believe this is so important is because a company I think that represents this new age isn't even Google or Apple, great companies. It's Toyota. Huh. And the way Toyota conquered the world and is the world's most successful auto company, while our big three are falling apart, is they said something very simple philosophy. The key to our success isn't just our CEO and our MBAs and our engineers. They're fine. The key to our success is tapping into the knowledge, the intelligence, the capabilities, the full talents of the people who work on the shop floor. And I think for the first time in history, we're only going to develop our economy. You know, what I think is the beauty of our time and why I'm so optimistic that after this crisis, that's why I call it the Great Reset, not the New Depression. It's an attempt to reset. It's an opportunity to reset ourselves. At the end of this, the only way out, the only way to get economic development is through further human development. So what I think are the way around the winners and the losers is to say no. We're going to invest we're going to make it a basic right, an economic right, an economic bill of rights, that you have the right to use your full and complete talent. We're going to invest in them. We're going to bolster them. We're going to show you a way. But on the other hand, you have an obligation. If we do that for you as a citizen, you have an obligation not to sit on your duff and be a slacker. You have an obligation to use your talent. The same way that we want to conserve and utilize our natural resources, no longer waste them, we have to utilize our full human resources and no longer waste even our most precious resource, our people. That's what I think is the way out. And I was very encouraged in the president's speech that he used language that was more or less analogous to that. We have to harness that talent, that capability of every American. Not only can no American be left behind, every one of us has to be contributing and using that talent if we're going to succeed. And I'm hoping, you know, sometimes against my own better judgment, but I think the logic of history pushes us in that direction.
Richard Florida, his article, The Great Reset, How the Crass Will Reshape America, is the cover story in the current issue of The Atlantic. Richard, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much.
Oh, man, thank you. Your questions were great. Our conversation was fabulous, and it's great to be part of the show again.